24. The first time Temple went to the head of the stairs, Minnie's eyeballs rolled out of the dusky light beside Miss Reba's door. Leaning once more within her bolted door, Temple heard Miss Reba toil up the stairs and knock. Temple leaned silently against the door while Miss Reba panted and wheezed beyond it with a mixture of blandishment and threat. She made no sound. After a while, Miss Reba went back down the stairs. Temple turned from the door and stood in the center of the room, beating her hands silently together, her eyes black in her livid face. She wore a street dress, a hat. She removed the hat and hurled it into a corner and went and flung herself face down upon the bed. The bed had not been made. The table beside it was littered with cigarette stubs, the adjacent floor strewn with ashes. The pillow slip on that side was spotted with brown holes. Often in the night she would wake to smell tobacco and to see the single ruby eye where Popeye's mouth would be. It was mid-morning. A thin bar of sunlight fell beneath the drawn shade of the south window, lying upon the sill and then upon the floor in a narrow band. The house was utterly quiet, with that quality as of spent breathing which it had in mid-morning. Now and then a car passed in the street beneath. Temple turned over on the bed. When she did so, she saw one of Popeye's innumerable black suits lying across a chair. She lay looking at it for a while, then she rose and snatched the garments up and hurled them into the corner where the hat was. In another corner was a closet improvised by a print curtain. It contained dresses of all sorts and all new. She ripped them down in furious wads and flung them after the suit and a row of hats from a shelf. Another of Popeye's suits hung there also. She flung it down. Behind it, hanging from a nail, was an automatic pistol in a holster of oiled silk. She took it down gingerly and removed the pistol and stood with it in her hand. After a moment, she went to the bed and hid it beneath the pillow. The dressing table was cluttered with toilet things, brushes and mirrors also new, with flasks and jars of delicate and bizarre shapes bearing French labels. One by one she gathered them up and hurled them into the corner in thuds and splintering crashes. Among them lay a platinum bag, a delicate webbing of metal upon the smug orange gleam of banknotes. This followed the other things into the corner, and she returned to the bed and lay again on her face in a slow thickening of expensive scent. At noon, Minnie tapped at the door.
"Here your dinner."
Temple didn't move.
"I gotta leave it here by the door. You can get it when you want it."
Her feet went away. Temple did not move. Slowly, the bar of sunlight shifted across the floor. The western side of the window frame was now in shadow. Temple sat up, her head turned aside as though she were listening, fingering with deft habitude at her hair. She rose quietly and went to the door and listened again. Then she opened it. The tray sat on the floor. She stepped over it and went to the stairs and peered over the rail. After a while, she made Minnie out, sitting in a chair in the hall.
"Minnie?"
she said. Minnie's head jerked up. Again her eyes rolled whitely. "Bring me a drink," Temple said. She returned to her room. She waited 15 minutes. She banged the door and was tramping furiously down the stairs when Minnie appeared in the hall.
"Yes'm,"
Minnie said.
"Miss Reba say we ain't got no—"
Miss Reba's door opened. Without looking up at Temple, she spoke to Minnie. Minnie lifted her voice again.
"Yes'm, all right. I'll bring it up in just a minute."
"You'd better," Temple said. She returned and stood just inside the door until she heard Minnie mount the stairs. Temple opened the door, holding it just ajar.
"Ain't you gonna eat no dinner?"
Minnie said, thrusting at the door with her knee. Temple held it too. "Where is it?" she said.
I ain't straightened your room up this morning, Minnie said.
Give it here, Temple said, reaching her hand through the crack. She took the glass from the tray.
You better make that and last, Minnie said. Miss Reba say you ain't gonna get no more. What you want to treat him this way for? Way he spent his money on you, you ought to be ashamed. He a right pretty little man, even if he ain't no John Gilbert. And way he's spending his money?
Temple shut the door and shot the bolt. She drank the gin and drew a chair up to the bed and lit a cigarette and sat down with her feet on the bed. After a while, she moved the chair to the window and lifted the shade a little so she could see the street beneath. She lit another cigarette. At 5 o'clock, she saw Miss Reba emerge in the black silk and flowered hat and go down the street. She sprang up and dug the hat from the mass of clothes in the corner and put it on. At the door, she turned and went back to the corner and exhumed the platinum purse and descended the stairs. Minnie was in the hall.
I'll give you $10, Temple said. I won't be gone 10 minutes.
I can't do it, Miss Temple. It'd be worth my job if Miss Reba find it out. And my throat, too, if Mr. Popeye do.
I swear I'll be back in 10 minutes. I swear I will.
$20. She put the bill in Minnie's hand.
You better come back,
Minnie said, opening the door.
If you ain't back here in 10 minutes, I ain't gonna be neither.
Temple opened the lattice and peered out. The street was empty, save for a taxi at the curb across the way and a man in a cap standing in a door beyond it. She went down the street, walking swiftly. At the corner, a cab overtook her, slowing, the driver looking at her interrogatively. She turned into the drugstore at the corner and went back to the telephone booth. Then she returned to the house. As she turned the corner, she met the man in the cap who had been leaning in the door. She entered the lattice. Minnie opened the door.
Thank goodness, Minnie said. When that cab over there started up, I got ready to pack up, too. If you ain't gonna say nothing about it, I get you a drink.
When Minnie fetched the gin, Temple started to drink it. Her hand was trembling, and there was a sort of elation in her face as she stood again just inside the door, listening, the glass in her hand. I'll need it later, she said. I'll need more than that. She covered the glass with a saucer and hid it carefully. Then she dug into the mass of garments in the corner and found a dancing frock and shook it out and hung it back in the closet. She looked at the other things a moment, but she returned to the bed and lay down again. At once she rose and drew the chair up and sat down, her feet on the unmade bed. While daylight died slowly in the room, she sat smoking cigarette after cigarette, listening to every sound on the stairs. At 6:30, Minnie brought her supper up. On the tray was another glass of gin.
Miss Reba sent this one, she said. She say, how you feeling?
Tell her, all right, Temple said.
I'm going to have a bath and then go to bed, tell her.
When Minnie was gone, Temple poured the two drinks into a tumbler and gloated over it, the glass shaking in her hands. She set it carefully away and covered it and ate her supper from the bed. When she finished, she lit a cigarette. Her movements were jerky. She smoked swiftly, moving about the room. She stood for a moment at the window, the shade lifted aside. Then she dropped it and turned into the room again, spying herself in the mirror. She turned before it, studying herself, puffing at the cigarette. She snapped it behind her, toward the fireplace, and went to the mirror and combed her hair. She ripped the curtain aside and took the dress down and laid it on the bed, and returned and drew out a drawer in the dresser and took a garment out. She paused with the garment in her hand. Then she replaced it and closed the drawer and caught up the frock swiftly and hung it back in the closet. A moment later, she found herself walking up and down the room, another cigarette burning in her hand, without any recollection of having lit it. She flung it away and went to the table and looked at her watch and propped it against the pack of cigarettes so she could see it from the bed and lay down. When she did so, she felt the pistol through the pillow. She slipped it out and looked at it. Then she slid it under her flank and lay motionless, her legs straight, her hands behind her head, her eyes focusing into black pinheads at every sound on the stairs. At 9, she rose. She picked up the pistol again. After a moment, she thrust it beneath the mattress and undressed. And in a spurious Chinese robe splotched with gold dragons and jade and scarlet flowers, she left the room. When she returned, her hair curled damply about her face. She went to the washstand and took up the tumbler, holding it in her hands, but she set it down again. She dressed, retrieving the bottles and jars from the corner. Her motions before the glass were furious yet painstaking. She went to the washstand and took up the glass, but again she paused and went to the corner and got her coat and put it on and put the platinum bag in the pocket and leaned once more to the mirror. Then she went and took up the glass and gulped the gin and left the room, walking swiftly. A single light burned in the hall. It was empty. She could hear voices in Miss Reba's room, but the lower hall was deserted. She descended swiftly and silently and gained the door. She believed that it would be at the door that they would stop her, and she thought of the pistol with acute regret, almost pausing, knowing that she would use it without any compunction whatever, with a kind of pleasure. She sprang to the door and pawed at the bolt, her head turned over her shoulder. It opened. She sprang out and out the lattice door and ran down the walk and out the gate. As she did so, a car, moving slowly along the curb, stopped opposite her. Popeye sat at the wheel. Without any apparent movement from him, the door swung open. He made no movement, spoke no word. He just sat there, the straw hat slanted a little aside.
"I won't," Temple said. "I won't."
He made no movement, no sound. She came to the car.
"I won't, I tell you."
Then she cried wildly,
"You're scared of him. You're scared to."
"I'm giving him his chance," he said. "Will you go back in that house, or will you get in this car?"
"You're scared to."
"I'm giving him his chance," he said, in his cold, soft voice. "Come on, make up your mind."
She leaned forward, putting her hand on his arm.
"Popeye," she said. "Daddy."
His arm felt frail, no larger than a child's, dead and hard and light as a stick.
"I don't care which you do," he said, "but do it. Come on."
She leaned toward him, her hand on his arm. Then she got into the car.
"You won't do it. You're afraid to. He's a better man than you are."
He reached across and shut the door.
"Where?" he said. "Grotto?"
"He's a better man than you are," Temple said shrilly. "You're not even a man. He knows it. Who does know it if he don't?"
The car was in motion. She began to shriek at him.
"You? A man? A bold, bad man, when you can't even... when you had to bring a real man into... and you hanging over the bed, moaning and slobbering like a... you couldn't fool me but once, could you? No wonder I bled and bl..."
His hand came over her mouth, hard, his nails going into her flesh. With the other hand, he drove the car at reckless speed. When they passed beneath lights, she could see him watching her as she struggled, tugging at his hand, whipping her head this way and that. She ceased struggling, but she continued to twist her head from side to side, tugging at his hand. One finger, ringed with a thick ring, held her lips apart, his fingertips digging into her cheek. With the other hand, he whipped the car in and out of traffic, bearing down upon other cars until they slewed aside with brakes squealing, shooting recklessly across intersections. Once a policeman shouted at them, but he did not even look around. Temple began to whimper, moaning behind his hand, drooling upon his fingers. The ring was like a dentist's instrument. She could not close her lips to regurgitate. When he removed it, she could feel the imprint of his fingers cold on her jaw. She lifted her hand to it.
"You hurt my mouth,"
she whimpered. They were approaching the outskirts of the city, the speedometer at 50 miles. His hat slanted above his delicate, hooked profile. She nursed her jaw. The houses gave way to broad, dark subdivisions out of which realtors' signs loomed abrupt and ghostly with a quality of forlorn assurance. Between them, low, far lights hung in the cool, empty darkness blowing with fireflies. She began to cry quietly, feeling the cooling double drink of gin inside her.
"You hurt my mouth,"
she said in a voice small and faint with self-pity. She nursed her jaw with experimental fingers, pressing harder and harder until she found it twinge.
"You'll be sorry for this,"
she said in a muffled voice, "when I tell Red." "Don't you wish you were Red? Don't you? Don't you wish you could do what he can do? Don't you wish he was the one watching us instead of you?" They turned into the grotto, passing along a closely curtained wall from which a sultry burst of music came. She sprang out while he was locking the car and ran on up the steps.
"I gave you your chance," she said. "You brought me here. I didn't ask you to come."
She went to the washroom. In the mirror, she examined her face.
"Shucks,"
she said.
"It didn't leave a mark, even."
Drawing the flesh this way and that.
"Little runt,"
she said, peering at her reflection. She added a phrase glibly obscene, with a detached parrot-like effect. She painted her mouth again. Another woman entered. They examined one another's clothes with brief, covert, cold, embracing glances. Popeye was standing at the door to the dance hall, a cigarette in his fingers.
"I gave you your chance," Temple said. "You didn't have to come."
"I don't take chances," he said.
"You took one," Temple said. "Are you sorry? Huh?"
"Go on," he said, his hand on her back.
She was in the act of stepping over the sill when she turned and looked at him, their eyes almost on a level. Then her hand flicked toward his armpit. He caught her wrist. The other hand flicked toward him. He caught that one, too, in his soft, cold hand. They looked eye to eye, her mouth open and the rouge spots darkening slowly on her face.
"I gave you your chance back there in town," he said. "You took it."
Behind her, the music beat, sultry, evocative, filled with movement of feet, the voluptuous hysteria of muscles warming the scent of flesh, of the blood.
"Oh, God! Oh, God!" she said, her lips scarce moving. "I'll go. I'll go back."
"You took it," he said. "Go on."
In his grasp, her hands made tentative plucking motions at his coat, just out of reach of her fingertips. Slowly, he was turning her toward the door. Her head reverted.
"You just dare," she cried. "You just—"
His hand closed upon the back of her neck, his fingers like steel, yet cold and light as aluminum. She could hear the vertebrae grating faintly together, and his voice cold and still.
"Will you?"
She nodded her head. Then they were dancing. She could still feel his hand at her neck. Across his shoulder, she looked swiftly about the room, her gaze flicking from face to face among the dancers. Beyond a low arch in another room, a group stood about the crap table. She leaned this way and that, trying to see the faces of the group. Then she saw the four men. They were sitting at a table near the door. One of them was chewing gum. The whole lower part of his face seemed to be cropped with teeth of an unbelievable whiteness and size. When she saw them, she swung Popeye around with his back to them, working the two of them toward the door again. Once more her harried gaze flew from face to face in the crowd. When she looked again, two of the men had risen. They approached. She dragged Popeye into their path, still keeping his back turned to them. The men paused and essayed to go around her. Again she backed Popeye into their path. She was trying to say something to him, but her mouth felt cold. It was like trying to pick up a pin with the fingers numb. Suddenly she felt herself lifted bodily aside, Popeye's small arms light and rigid as aluminum. She stumbled back against the wall and watched the two men leave the room.
"I'll go back," she said. "I'll go back."
She began to laugh shrilly.
"Shut it," Popeye said. "Are you gonna shut it?"
"Get me a drink," she said. She felt his hand. Her legs felt cold, too, like they were not hers. They were sitting at a table. Two tables away, the man was still chewing, his elbows on the table. The fourth man sat on his spine, smoking, his coat buttoned across his chest. She watched hands, a brown one in a white sleeve, a soiled white one beneath a dirty cuff, setting bottles on the table. She had a glass in her hand. She drank, gulping. With the glass in her hand, she saw Red standing in the door, in a gray suit and a spotted bow tie. He looked like a college boy, and he looked about the room until he saw her. He looked at the back of Popeye's head, then at her as she sat with the glass in her hand. The two men at the other table had not moved. She could see the faint, steady movement of the one's ears as he chewed. The music started. She held Popeye's back toward Red. He was still watching her, almost a head taller than anybody else.
"Come on," she said in Popeye's ear. "If you're going to dance, dance."
She had another drink. They danced again. Red had disappeared. When the music ceased, she had another drink. It did no good. It merely lay hot and hard inside her.
"Come on," she said. "Don't quit."
But he wouldn't get up, and she stood over him, her muscles flinching and jerking with exhaustion and terror. She began to jeer at him.
"Call yourself a man? A bold, bad man, and let a girl dance you off your feet?"
Then her face drained, became small and haggard and sincere. She spoke like a child, with sober despair.
"Popeye."
He sat with his hands on the table, finicking with a cigarette, the second glass with its melting ice before him. She put her hand on his shoulder.
"Daddy,"
she said. Moving to shield them from the room, her hand stole toward his armpit, touching the butt of the flat pistol. It lay rigid in the light, dead vice of his arm and side.
"Give it to me,"
she whispered.
"Daddy. Daddy?"
She leaned her thigh against his shoulder, caressing his arm with her flank.
"Give it to me, Daddy,"
she whispered. Suddenly her hand began to steal down his body in a swift, covert movement. Then it snapped away in a movement of revulsion.
"I forgot," she whispered. I didn't mean.
One of the men at the other table hissed once through his teeth.
"Sit down," Popeye said.
She sat down. She filled her glass, watching her hands perform the action. Then she was watching the corner of the gray coat.
"He's got a broken button," she thought stupidly.
Popeye had not moved. "Dance, sis," Red said. His head was bent, but he was not looking at her. He was turned a little, facing the two men at the other table. Still, Popeye did not move. He shredded delicately the end of the cigarette, pinching the tobacco off. Then he put it into his mouth.
"I'm not dancing,"
Temple said through her cold lips. "Not?" Red said. he said in a level tone, without moving. How's the boy?
Fine, Popeye said.
Temple watched him scrape a match, saw the flame distorted through glass.
You've had enough, Popeye said.
His hand took the glass from her lips. She watched him empty it into the ice bowl. The music started again. She sat looking quietly about the room. A voice began to buzz faintly at her hearing. Then Popeye was gripping her wrist, shaking it, and she found that her mouth was open and that she must have been making a noise of some sort with it.
Shut it now, he said. You can have one more.
He poured the drink into the glass.
I haven't felt it at all, she said.
He gave her the glass. She drank. When she set the glass down, she realized that she was drunk. She believed that she had been drunk for some time. She thought that perhaps she had passed out and that it had already happened. She could hear herself saying, I hope it has. I hope it has. Then she believed it had, and she was overcome by a sense of bereavement and of physical desire. She thought, it will never be again. And she sat in a floating swoon of agonized sorrow and erotic longing, thinking of Red's body, watching her hand holding the empty bottle over the glass.
You've drunk it all, Popeye said. Get up now. Dance it off.
They danced again. She moved stiffly and languidly, her eyes open but unseeing, her body following the music without hearing the tune for a time. Then she became aware that the orchestra was playing the same tune as when Red was asking her to dance. If that were so, then it couldn't have happened yet. She felt a wild surge of relief. It was not too late. Red was still alive. She felt long, shuddering waves of physical desire going over her, draining the color from her mouth, drawing her eyeballs back into her skull in a shuddering swoon. They were at the crap table. She could hear herself shouting to the dice. She was rolling them, winning. The counters were piling up in front of her as Popeye drew them in, coaching her, correcting her in his soft, querulous voice. He stood beside her. Shorter than she. He had the cup himself. She stood beside him cunningly, feeling the desire going over her in wave after wave, involved with the music and with the smell of her own flesh. She became quiet. By infinitesimal inches, she moved aside until someone slipped into her place. Then she was walking swiftly and carefully across the floor toward the door. The dancers, the music swirling slowly about her in a bright myriad wave. The table where the two men had sat was empty, but she did not even glance at it. She entered the corridor. A waiter met her. Room, she said. Hurry. The room contained a table and four chairs. The waiter turned on the light and stood in the door. She jerked her hand at him. He went out. She leaned against the table on her braced arms, watching the door, until Red entered. He came toward her. She did not move. Her eyes began to grow darker and darker, lifting into her skull above a half moon of white, without focus, with the blank rigidity of a statue's eyes. She began to say, ah, 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 in an expiring voice, her body arching slowly backward, as though faced by an exquisite torture. When he touched her, she sprang like a bow, hurling herself upon him. Her mouth gaped and ugly like that of a dying fish as she writhed her loins against him. He dragged his face free by main strength, with her hips grinding against him, her mouth gaping and straining protrusion bloodless. She began to speak.
Let's hurry, anywhere. I've quit him. I told him so. It's not my fault. Is it my fault? You don't need your hat, and I don't either. He came here to kill you, but I said I gave him his chance. It wasn't my fault. And now it'll just be us, without him there watching. Come on. What are you waiting for?
She strained her mouth toward him, dragging his head down, making a whimpering moan. He held his face free.
I told him I was. I said, if you bring me here, I gave you your chance, I said. And now he's got them there to bump you off. But you're not afraid, are you?
Did you know that when you telephoned me? He said.
What? He said I wasn't to see you again. He said he'd kill you. But he had me followed when I telephoned. I saw him.
But you're not afraid.
He's not even a man.
But you are. You're a man. You're a man. She began to grind against him, dragging at his head, murmuring to him in parrot-like underworld epithet, the saliva running pale over her bloodless lips.
Are you afraid?
Of that dopey bastard? Lifting her bodily, he turned so that he faced the door and slipped his right hand free. She did not seem to be aware that he had moved.
Please, 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 please don't make me wait. I'm burning up.
All right. You go on back. You wait till I give you the sign. Will you go on back?
I can't wait. You've got to. I'm on fire, I tell you.
She clung to him. Together they blundered across the room toward the door, he holding her clear of his right side, she in a voluptuous swoon, unaware that they were moving, straining at him as though she were trying to touch him with all of her body surface at once. He freed himself and thrust her into the passage. Go on, he said. I'll be there in a minute.
You won't be long. I'm on fire. I'm dying, I tell you.
No, not long. Go on now. The music was playing. She moved up the corridor, staggering a little. She thought that she was leaning against the wall when she found that she was dancing again. Then that she was dancing with two men at once. Then she found that she was not dancing, but that she was moving toward the door between the man with the chewing gum and the one with the buttoned coat. She tried to stop, but they had her under the arms. She opened her mouth to scream, taking one last despairing look about the swirling room. Yell, the man with the button coat said. Just try it once. Red was at the crap table. She saw his head turned, the cup in his lifted hand. With it he made her a short, cheery salute. He watched her disappear through the door between the two men. Then he looked briefly about the room. His face was bold and calm, but there were two white lines at the base of his nostrils, and his forehead was damp. He rattled the cup and threw the dice steadily. 11, the dealer said. Let it lay, Red said. I'll pass a million times tonight. They helped Temple into the car. The man in the button coat took the wheel. Where the drive joined the lane that led to the high road, a long touring car was parked. When they passed it, Temple saw, leaning to a cupped match, Popeye's delicate hooked profile beneath the slanted hat as he lit the cigarette. The match flipped outward like a dying star in miniature, sucked with the profile into darkness by the rush of their passing.